Make the choice to begin anywhere in your life, and the journey has started.
We exist more than just to educate. We exist to also revitalize.
And along the way, you can inspire others and be inspired.
But now there's a new generation of scholars, and I am among them.
If you really want to know who you are and what you are capable of, Howard is the choice for you.
Take a moment. Listen to the stories by joining the president of Howard University, Dr. Wayne A.I. Frederick, and his guest on The Journey.
Election day is just around the corner, and one of the sons of Howard University will be on the ballot. He is the first African-American candidate to run for United States Senate in the state of Mississippi, and he will share the story of how Howard University has made an impact in his life and in his political career. Hello, my name is Dr. Wayne Frederick. My guest today on The Journey is Mike Espy, former Secretary of Agriculture and Democratic candidate for U.S. Senate in Mississippi. Welcome, Secretary. How are you?
Doing well, Mr. President. Thank you so much, and thank you for this opportunity.
Oh, absolutely. My pleasure. So let's jump right in. You ran in 2018, garnered some 47% of the vote in Mississippi. Obviously, ran a very good race. What is different about today in 2020 than back then?
Well, the first thing is that we have more time. Your viewers should know that I ran in 2018, but the incumbent who had the office fell ill, and he resigned in March of that same year, and the election was in November. So by the time we decided to run, we could stand up a campaign, we could raise the money, we could choose the staff. We only had about 6 months to run, but we still got 47% of the vote.
Oh, that's excellent. And now you have more time, obviously, but what about the infrastructure? I think most of my viewers probably do not have a contemporary notion of Mississippi. Why don't you paint for them a picture of what the electorate is like in Mississippi today?
Well, in 2020, the population of Mississippi is 60% white and 40% black. So right there, you know, we have a great basis to move from, because we have more black voters per capita than any state in the nation. And so therefore, my challenge on the white side, we have less of a threshold to get white votes because we have so many African-Americans here to vote. So my challenge is just to get them out.
And how?
In 2018, I got 99% of the black vote.
Right.
When they come, they'll vote for me, very likely, but only 32.5% actually showed up.
I got you.
So that's our job, is to lift that turnout at least 3 or 4 more percent.
Now, I would imagine that while mobilizing the African-American vote is clearly a sound strategy, when you head to the halls of Congress, you're representing all the citizens of Mississippi.
Yes.
What about the appeal in the white community? What is your platform to appealing to those in the white community?
Well, yes, you know, we will get black votes, but we cannot win with black votes alone, nor should we. So here in Mississippi, we believe we're gonna need at least 22% of the white vote. And our latest polling shows that we're right now at 20. And so we're appealing to them on the same issues that we're appealing to everyone.
Let's talk a little bit about health. How has the pandemic affected the citizens of Mississippi?
Well, we're a small state with about 3 million people, and already, unfortunately, we have over 3,000 who've already died. Most of them, of course, 65 or more African-American. We have more than 130,000 of those in Mississippi who have been affected by the virus. Because because of the lack of health investments in Mississippi, which is a legacy of disinvestment, we have all these comorbidities. So as soon as the virus strikes, of course, it just accelerates and raises to our community. We also have conservative leadership that has advised all Mississippians that they no longer have to wear a mask on a mandatory basis. So I just tell everybody, your mask protects me, my mask protects you. Even though now it's no longer mandatory, we have to keep wearing this and comply with CDC guidelines until we can get a vaccine.
You grew up in Yazoo City, Mississippi. When you grew up and went to high school there compared to now, what are the biggest changes over that period of time?
And this is what I want to say about Howard. Thank you for that question. I'm so indebted to Howard because coming out of that high school, really Howard was the only school that would accept me. And I want to tell you why. I come from a large family in a town of about 17,000 people. And all of my siblings, I'm the youngest. I do have a twin sister. She also went to Howard, only school we applied to. So we went to a parochial school that closed for lack of money. And we were in our junior year. So my parents had to make the decision to send the twins to the all-black school or the all-white school. The white school had better facilities, better laboratory, better books. So my parents, they did the right thing. But Mr. President, it was the worst time of my life, even today. Every day I was called the N-word. There were 17 black students among a student body of 800 white students. So think about it. This is 1968. My teachers embarrassed me in class by spraying me with a high-pressure water hose in class. Because of a question that they asked me. So when the schools merged the next year, I was a senior, and all the black students came over, but none of the black teachers did. No black teacher was offered a contract. So I had been elected the black president of the senior class. You know, they were dual, white president, black president. Yep. So I led a walkout of the black students to protest the fact that none of the black teachers had received a contract. And that march was very successful. So successful, to my detriment, that I was called into the county superintendent's office. And he told me, Mr. Espy, because you led the walkout, we're gonna dock you two GPA points for every day you're out. And we were out 3 days. So when I'm a senior beginning to apply from college on a 4.0 scale, my GPA as a senior had been docked 6 points. So I applied to Howard. And so my standardized tests were pretty good. So Howard said, so what's the problem? Why is your GPA so low? And I worked with the admissions office at Howard, and I made them understand Jim Crow, Mississippi, 1971 Mississippi, and what we did to lead the walkout and why I was penalized. And they said, we understand. Come on to the capstone. This is an academically outstanding university, but here you will be comfortable. Here nobody's gonna call you the N-word unless it's in a different context. No one's gonna spray you with a high pressure water extinguisher, and nobody's gonna dock your GPA for protesting. So look, Howard was my first choice. I'm just so indebted that Howard University listened to my story. Let me explain why my GPA was so unusually low, and just beckoned me on to the capstone.
Right. No. Excellent. And so, just to get back to Mississippi, you then moved back to Mississippi after law school. Why? What drew you back to a place that obviously had given you so much difficulty and put up so many barriers to your success?
Being honest with you, it was the death of my father, so it was a family issue. When I left Howard, I received a full scholarship to law school in California. So I love California, love the West, love the warm weather, love the ocean, and I intended to stay there. But in my third year, my father died. So once I returned to Mississippi, I took the bar exam. Excuse me. I raised this because in Mississippi in 1978, when I took it. There was only one state-sponsored law school, which obviously I did not attend. And when you graduated from Ole Miss Law School, they gave you a diploma. They gave you your bar license at the same time. So when those of us who didn't go to Ole Miss, when we returned to take the bar exam, the pass rate was 3%. 3%. And when I took it, there was no bar reviews. Because the pass rate was so awful. So I actually took the course, I passed it the first time, because of the education I received at Howard at my law school, I passed it. I began working with the indigent. Then I began to run for office. I was the first Black Assistant Secretary of State, first Black Assistant Attorney General, first Black member of Congress since Reconstruction, only African-American to ever become Secretary of Agriculture, and ran for the Senate 18 months ago and got 47%. So all of this based on my experiences at Howard and at my law school.
The hearings for the recently nominated Supreme Court justice are taking place as we speak. And as you look at that process, do you have any concerns about the Senate taking that up now prior to the election versus waiting for the outcome of the presidential race to then decide, or even the Senate for that matter?
Of course, it's a power grab, it's a rush. They want Justice Barrett on the Supreme Court bench to be there in time for the November 10th hearing. That will be an appeal from Texas to eviscerate the Affordable Care Act. So I think that it's a wrong-headed move on the part of the Senate, the Republicans in the Senate, and our president. You know, when Justice Ginsburg died, her dying wish, the wish on her deathbed, was a very reasonable wish. And it was simply that her successor not be nominated until the next president had been inaugurated. And here in Mississippi, we've already started voting. They already started voting since September 21st. And so those voters have no say in who's going to be put on the Supreme Court bench. So I think it's wrong. It's contrary to what they did with the previous Obama nominee. They just stopped it, and it's just wrong. They should wait.
Well, elections matter, and obviously the 2016 election was extremely critical to the nation. And so when people say they're not going to go to the polls because they don't have the ideal candidate, it concerns me. And I try to talk to young people about that all the time. What message do you have as we are on the precipice of yet another election for the young people who will hear this and will listen, or for that matter, the Howard community? What message do you have as we get into this election and as it pertains to your own candidacy?
I speak to them every day in Mississippi, and I've even spoken to them from Howard by digital means, by Zoom. And for those of them who have concern for history, I can just raise the names of Medgar Evers, who was shot in the back as the head of the NAACP in Mississippi, shot in the back by Coward as he was entering his home to kiss his own children after a day of registering African Americans to vote. Fannie Lou Hamer, who ran for Congress in 1964, the same seat that I won in 1986. She ran in 1964, and I'm standing on her shoulders because decades before, she knew there was no way that she could ever win. But nonetheless, she was courageous, and she was fearless, and she ran anyway for the right to vote. And Vernon Damer, an African-American here in Mississippi, whose truck was blown to smithereens by the Ku Klux Klan because he registered African-Americans to vote in the 60s. Those three names and a pantheon of others, you know, a myriad of others, all sacrificed, bled, toll for the right to vote. So I just say to the millennials and the Gen Zs, just like I'm standing on their shoulders, you are as well. Well,
Secretary Espy, we thank you for your courage, your conviction. You're a true son of Howard, and you certainly are representing us in the best way possible. We wish you well, and we wish you the best of luck on election night on November 3rd. And please know that you always have a home here at Howard University.
Thank you. Now, at the law school, they have something called the Espy Food Prize. And I'm a lecturer there on agriculture and food systems. So thank you so much, and go Bisons.
Absolutely. Thanks for being here. My guest today was Mike Espy, the former Secretary of Agriculture and Democratic candidate for U.S. Senate in Mississippi. I'm Dr. Wayne Frederick. Please join me next time on The Journey.